an investigation of the Arnie Fugelvog case.
All they had to do was do a standard boarding. They'd find the illegal fish and they'd give them probable cause to do everything that they needed to do to get the information.
How the Alaskan who almost became the top fisheries official in the country ended up contemplating jail time instead. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new study on the problem of declining oil in the Trans-Alaska pipeline system.
For a modest investment, they're going to make billions of dollars in profit.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
When Senator Murkowski's fisheries aide pulled out from consideration for an influential job in the Obama administration 2 years ago, he said it was because the process was taking too long. It turns out Arnie Fugelvog was under investigation by the very agency he would have run. Fugelvog pleaded guilty last month to breaking commercial fishing law before joining Murkowski's staff. His admission shook the commercial fishing industry in Alaska, where Fugelvog had served on influential councils. Now, former crew members are coming forward saying they tried to turn Fugelvog into authorities for years and felt like they were ignored. APRN's Libby Casey has this investigative report.
As early as 2007, two of Arnie Fugelvog's crew members tried to alert authorities to his illegal fishing. One would not go on the record for fear being blacklisted by the fishing community, but the other is talking on tape for the first time. Dan Price was reluctant, but agreed to meet at a diner near his home in the lower 48. He gives an example of how they'd fish someplace like the central Gulf of Alaska instead of where they were supposed to, west of Kodiak.
It's over a 20-hour run. So to run out there will cost you thousands of dollars in the fuel. There's no numbers of fish there. What you can do in a 10-hour period in Central Gulf is going to take you a week west of Kodiak. Plus, it's going to cost you at least an extra $5,000 to $10,000 in expenses. So to save that and to save time so we could get home or he could get to his meetings, we all into it because it got us home sooner too.
Price worked on the vessel, the Camelar, for 16 years, starting when Arnie Fugelvog's dad was in charge. He stayed on board when Arnie took over until Price lost his job in 2005. He says the crewman who replaced him had his own quotas to fish, which meant the boat could catch more. He got upset watching Fugelvog rise through the ranks of the fishing management world, sitting on major councils that allowed him to shape policy and gain influence. Yet Price knew that even as Fugelvog was held up as a model fisherman, he'd been breaking the rules for over a decade. Fugelvog went to Washington to work for Senator Murkowski on fisheries issues in the fall of 2006, and the following spring, Dan Price started calling law enforcement. At first, he was scared, using anonymous payphones and trying to find out if he would get in trouble, but he says the feds told him they weren't in the habit of hanging out to dry the people who helped them. On May 11, 2007 alone, Price's phone records show 9 calls to National Marine Fisheries law enforcement in Alaska. He says initially the feds seemed interested. A crew member who shared Price's concerns and knew he was blowing the whistle tipped Price off in June 2007 that the Camelar was docking in Petersburg with illegal fish. Now, Arnie Fugelvog was not on board. He'd gone to Washington, leaving in charge a hired skipper. But Price says evidence on the boat could have exposed information about when Fugelvog was captain.
I called the National Marine Fisheries and told them, here's your opportunity to get the logbooks, get the computer, and find out that I was telling the truth. All they had to do was do a standard boarding. If they did a regular detailed boarding, they'd find the illegal fish and they'd give them probable cause to do everything that they needed to do to get the information.
One day later, federal officers with National Marine Fisheries, or NMFS, boarded the boat and seized rockfish and halibut that weren't reported on the fish ticket. The crew said they were for personal use, not to sell, but it was a lot. The rockfish weighed 1,300 pounds after being headed and gutted. They'd hid the catch, packing the rockfish in 2 totes that were covered in cocoa mats to make them look unused. The feds and state slapped the skipper and boat with about $11,000 in penalties for misdemeanors and violations, including lying to an official. But in the course of the investigation, an Alaska wildlife trooper interviewed a crew member who provided some damning information. The deckhand had been aboard the Camelar for over 20 years and said this has happened every year, once or twice a year. He talks about taking bycatch off the boat at night or offloading to tenders that wouldn't be boarded by authorities. He said he knew it wasn't right, but that if he'd blown the whistle, he would have been out of a job. NIMS officials won't say whether those comments prompted follow-up or if they were looking at a bigger problem than the isolated offense of taking home bycatch. But Dan Price says they contacted him.
It was very shortly after, within a day or a couple days, they called and they asked me to wear a wire. They asked me if I would wear a hidden mic and contact Arnie, and I just told them no. And the reason is because Arnie and I aren't friends, because I was pissed at him for taking my job. So I told him no, it won't do any good, and there's no point to it. Plus, it would tip the hand, I thought.
After that, Price heard nothing. He says when he called NIMS, he was told a variety of things, including that the case was being pursued by the state, but no news on what the feds were doing about his accusations against Fuglevog, which were much bigger than failing to report home pack on a fish ticket. Price's phone records show at least 16 calls to NIMS law enforcement that fall.
The next time I called, they told me that their supervisors, the people in charge of the Juneau Enforcement Office, they said that their boss had told them that the case was over. They had done a complete and thorough investigation. They could find no wrongdoing and that the case was closed.
But Price and three other longtime crew members say back in 2007 and 2008, authorities never questioned them as part of an investigation. Whether the feds dug into Price's claims is unknown. APRN has requested records, but the recent acting director of NOAA's Office of Law Enforcement, Alan Reisenhoover, would not be interviewed and said in writing that it does not comment on whether it is or has been conducting investigations and that it takes all complaints seriously and acts on them as needed. So Fuglevog stayed at his job at Senator Murkowski's office, and Dan Price grew increasingly upset. Then in April 2009, Fuglevog had been so successful in Washington that he was one of two candidates being considered to run the National Marine Fisheries Service. Price found out almost by accident.
I was just calling to say hello to one of the crew, and his wife said, "Oh, you heard about Arnie?" And I was like, "What?" And he said, "Oh, he's going to be the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service." And I said, "My ass." And they said, "Yeah." I said, "I got to go." And I sat right down and I stayed up all night and I just started typing out as much as I could, writing a letter, trying to expose everything that I could.
Price says he couldn't believe that the man he'd been trying to turn in for 2 years might run the very agency Price was trying to make listen.
At first, I called up the National Marine Fisheries Office in Juneau and I asked them what happened to the case from before, and they told me that there never had been one. I guess this was April of 2009. And they told me that there never was a case. There was never any conversation. There never was an investigation. There was no case against Arnie Fuglevog.
Price spent the summer trying to get a response. He sent out his email detailing his claims against Fuglevog to bloggers and anti-catshare activists in the fishing world. Then a crew member came up with the actual logbooks, which showed where they'd really fished, as opposed to what Fuglevog documented in the official logs. Price says he faxed a copy to NIMS law enforcement. But Price never turned to a major media outlet and didn't contact Fuglevog's boss, Senator Murkowski. He says he wanted the authorities to take him seriously. Believing that NIMS was ignoring his information, he finally called the FBI Ethics Office in Anchorage. He heard that NOAA Fisheries Enforcement was being investigated by the Inspector General's Office of the Commerce Department, so he emailed the IG's office in July and called its complaint hotline.
That night at like 9, 10, or 11 o'clock at night, I got a phone call with a conference call with five federal agents, and they talked to me for 2.5 hours, and just asking me the entire, from start to finish, what happened.
Price got a follow-up email in October from a special agent in the Inspector General's Investigations Wing apologizing for the delays and asking to talk more. Meanwhile, other things were starting to happen. Price's email was making the rounds. It got into the hands of a top guy at Greenpeace USA, John Hocevar, the Oceans Campaign Director. He took it seriously, even though he didn't know the former fisherman who'd written it.
The allegations that we received really had a lot of information about, where the fishing was taking place, the amount of money involved. It really lended a certain amount of credibility to the allegations.
Hosovar says he'd gotten similar phone calls claiming that Fuglevog had for years illegally fished. So in June 2009, he forwarded the email to the woman responsible for hiring the new NIMS director, Dr. Jane Lubchenco, the head of NOAA. Hosovar did not hear back, but assumed his message got through.
While I didn't receive a response from Jane Lubchenco, I was pretty confident that she would take action. You know, it's not unusual for them to avoid wanting to comment on things that involve legal issues.
By the end of July, news reports said Lubchenco had reopened her search for a NIMS head. The Massachusetts newspaper, the Gloucester Times, reported that weeks earlier, the acting director of NIMS was told he'd be sticking around longer than planned. Fuglevog officially pulled his name out of consideration on July 31st, saying the process was taking too long. But it turns out by then, an investigation was underway, and crew members were being interviewed. NOAA's Dr. Lubchenco will not comment on the timing. APRN caught up with her in Washington at a recent event where the U.S. pledged to combat illegal fishing. Asked about vetting Fuglevog for the NIMS job, Lubchenco had this to say.
It's not appropriate for me to comment on individuals, but, you know, I've been following the progress of that story as it's unfolded.
Lubchenco would not say whether she passed along any information about Fuglevog to the White House, since the NIMS job was a presidential appointment, or to the two Alaska senators who were supporting the hometown fishermen in his bid, Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich. But a NOAA spokesman writes that no one outside of NOAA would be told about ongoing investigations. Bloggers and critics have asked how Senator Murkowski could not have known that her staffer was being accused by his own crew members and was then under investigation for a year and a half. The senator says she didn't find out until the end of 2010, but John Hosovar with Greenpeace says the rumors were making the rounds.
Impossible for me to imagine that Senator Murkowski was not aware of these allegations. I can't imagine that.
Senator Murkowski insists she didn't know, and nothing was reported in major media outlets.
I'm not quite sure what it was that people were hearing, because we weren't hearing it. We weren't hearing it. I would not have hired anybody on my staff that was the subject of an investigation.
So Fuglevog kept his job until 2 months ago, one day before he was formally charged. Now, instead of being the nation's top fisherman, Arne Fuglevog awaits his sentencing hearing and faces 10 months behind bars. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a man living a subsistence lifestyle near Sitka loses everything.
To steal someone's ability to survive and make a living, down to the dirty clothes and toothpaste, it's not really appreciated.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
North Rim Bank, taking your business to the next level. With help from North Rim Bank, spot the turns and opportunities that lie ahead for Alaska. More at NorthRim.com. Member FDIC.
A new study on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System has an optimistic take on the problem of declining oil in the pipeline. At its peak, the pipeline had 2 million barrels of oil a day flowing through it, but today it averages 600,000 barrels, and that rate is declining. The new report was paid for by the environmental group Natural Resources Defense Council. It shows once throughput drops below 500,000 barrels per day, ice and wax can accumulate in the pipeline. But there are relatively easy fixes for the problems. Lois Epstein is an engineer who works for the Wilderness Society and reviewed the study.
What is needed to prevent problems of low flow are heaters at certain locations and also potentially some increased pig runs, which will ensure that there aren't problems with wax.
With the upgrades, NRDC estimates the pipeline could operate safely for another 3 decades. The NRDC report is a critique of a study released in June by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, which operates TAPS. The two documents agree on many points, but the Alyeska report highlighted the challenges of retrofitting the pipeline to handle the colder oil. In contrast, the NRDC report makes the case that those changes will be well worth it in the long run.
For a modest investment of essentially a few $100 million, the producers on the North Slope, who are also owners of the TAPS pipeline, they're going to make billions of dollars in profits.
Alyeska says their report shows it's much easier to increase the amount of oil in the pipeline than retrofitting it to handle lower flows. But Alyeska spokeswoman Michelle Egan says the company can't wait for that to happen. She says they are already making some changes, but she hopes the company won't have to make the extensive adjustments necessary at very low flow rates.
The reality is that operating at 300,000 barrels or 200,000 barrels a day is not a good place for the pipeline to be. It was designed to operate at 1.5 million barrels a day, nor is it a good place for the state of Alaska to be. That's less than half of the throughput that's in the pipeline today.
The two reports disagree on how quickly TAPS will fall below 500,000 barrels per day. NRDC estimates it won't happen until 2024, while Alyeska puts the date much earlier, around 2016. Residents of Anchor Point are one step closer to connecting their homes to natural gas. At their meeting in Homer Tuesday night, members of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly voted to approve a USAD, or Utility Special Assessment District, to finance distribution lines throughout the town. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
The plan is for the borough to finance 40,000 feet of gas pipeline in Anchor Point at a total cost of just over $723,000. Over a period of 10 years, the property owners in the USAD will pay the money back plus interest. Even though the cost per property owner is nothing to sneeze at, about $2,700 per parcel, the residents overwhelmingly signed on to a petition this year approving the formation of the USAD to the tune of over 75% of the population. Borough Mayor Dave Carey called it the largest special assessment district the borough has ever been involved with. He said it was a big thing for Anchor Point and a hopeful step toward a gas pipeline for the Homer area.
This is a real good thing, and hopefully as we continue to work to see that there is a natural gas pipeline brought down from Anchor Point to Homer to Kachemak City, this would certainly help with that movement.
There was one Anchor Point resident who felt strongly enough in his opposition to the assessment that he made the trip to Homer to testify before the assembly. Al Poindexter said a snafu with his property lines, having to do with an error by his surveyor, will mean he'll be paying assessments for 4 lots that he considers to be one.
I don't think that's right. I don't think it's right that I wasn't allowed to vote on this assessment, number one, on this USAD. I don't think it's right that this law doesn't allow for any appeal. And I want everybody to understand that I'm not against the USAD. I'm not against the deal. I'm against the way I'm going to be assessed.
Borough Attorney Colette Thompson said the legal description of all properties as of the date the petition was accepted, July 5th, would be the way the properties are assessed. Another Anchor Point resident, Emmett Trumbull, testified in favor of the USAD, saying the community had worked for 35 years to get access to natural gas.
And this is a great opportunity for the community. There's been a lot of volunteer effort. And obviously, we had a great response to have well over the 70% that was necessary. So I would encourage you to adopt this and appropriate those funds. Thank you very much.
Moments later, the assembly unanimously approved an ordinance appropriating the money. Assembly members also approved a resolution Tuesday night calling on Governor Sean Parnell to include funding in his 2013 capital budget for construction of a natural gas pipeline into Homer and Kachemak City. South Peninsula Representatives Mako Haggerty and Bill Smith sponsored the resolution. Smith said the governor had a chance this year to correct what he called a mistake in not funding the pipeline the last 2 years. He pointed out that Parnell, in his reasoning for not funding the pipeline this year, said Homer had received many other capital improvement items, including improvements for cruise ship passengers at the Deepwater Dock.
One of the items included there, besides restrooms and a rain shelter for the tourists, is a bird poop washer. My question essentially to the governor, I wrote a letter, it's in the paper today, is would the citizens of Homer choose a bird poop washer over a natural gas line? And my answer is not only no, but hell no.
Kerry said a meeting was being planned for late October between borough officials and Governor Parnell for the express purpose of lobbying for the South Peninsula Pipeline. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
An entourage of Alaska Airlines executives and upper managers were in Bethel as part of a rural tour to learn more about the customers in their backyard. Participants at the Bethel Chamber of Commerce meeting told the airline officials what they liked and didn't like about flying with the airline. The trip took place last month, but some of the changes they discussed could be seen in the future. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
The meeting was billed as a unique opportunity to meet with the decision makers for Bethel's major airline, but it didn't bother anyone that they came to give away some free plane tickets.
956695.
With just a dozen Bethelites in the room, the odds were 6-1. Bethel resident Tiffany Logan was that one, winning the first of two drawings.
Oh, that's me.
The drawings occurred after a lively and friendly question and answer session. The luncheon crowd was quick to lay praise on the airline. Logan, even before she won the ticket, said she was pleased with the company's attitude and their customer service. Other praise came for their in-state luggage policy and their improvements keeping flight schedules. Bethel High School's Dean of Students Billy Strickland said that Alaska Airlines does a nice job of supporting athletic travel. Strickland is also a representative of the state's High School Athletic Association, and he said there is more the airline could try and do. He said one thing would be allowing teams to change student passengers last minute with greater ease.
Any kind of help we could with late minute name changes on tickets is huge because eligibility, kids getting hurt and so forth.
He also said the airline is leaving sales on the table all over Alaska by not giving parents better deals when their children qualify for state tournaments.
Because a lot of times you won't know your kids qualified for a state tournament till the weekend before.
Yeah.
And you really want to go,
right,
but you don't really want to buy that walk-up fare.
Yeah. Manager Scott Haberson said the airline is trying to pinpoint those kinds of events where a discounted ticket price could mean more sales.
So we've done discounts, generic discounts in the past, but I think we can do a better job of putting fares in the market when you want them for good reasons. And I think you'll see some good stuff coming from us from that.
Anyone who's purchased a plane ticket from the bush knows that those full-price tickets are the highest prices per mile you'll find pretty much anywhere in the nation. Alaska Airlines President Bill Tillman says the airline is trying to bring down their prices to encourage more customers.
The more you charge, the fewer people that can afford to pay it. It's one of our biggest issues. It's one of our biggest issues for the entire airline, but it's most pronounced in rural Alaska.
Tillman hinted at some sort of price reduction for rural customers.
I think we're going to have something to talk to you guys about in a couple of months that will make this a little bit better.
But he quickly tempered any expectations, saying that a substantial reduction will take some time to accomplish.
It does cost more to operate up here. And so what it is we got to get our cost of operation down so that we can bring our fares down. I just want to assure you, I get it. It's something that I know we help Bethel. It's also in our company's interest to address this problem in a pretty serious way.
Tillman and other top staff were speaking at the Chamber of Commerce meeting held at the log cabin in Bethel. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
A man whose camping gear was stolen while he was in a remote bay near Sitka says the crime was much more than a simple theft. And friends are offering a reward for information that leads to an arrest. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
This is the story of a man named Kelly Tidwell, who first came to Southeast Alaska on a kayaking trip.
I had set everything up so it was open-ended. See how I like it, and it ends when I'm done. And it was 5 years ago, and I'm still not done. I got off the ferry in Ketchikan, paddled around Revilla, and I said, this is perfect.
So perfect, in fact, that the trip is still going. Wherever Tidwell goes, all of his possessions come with him.
And I camp out on the island year-round. I mean, it's been done by people for thousands of years. It still works.
On September 16th, he was in Nakwasina Sound, which is north of Sitka. He went hunting, bagged a deer, tagged it, came back to camp, made coffee, traded out his slugs for steel shot, and then went back out duck hunting.
It was high tide, and I was hunting in the marshes that were all flooded, which was just awesome fun. You know, weaseling the kayak through these little channels in the water, and there's just dead pinks everywhere, and there was very few ducks, but you'd still pop them up really close. I mean, it was just an awesome time. And, you know, I got back at about, you know, four or so, and plans changed.
Plans changed. He paddles back to his campsite, and he notices that things are out of order.
Everything I had in the whole world was gone.
Almost everything. His tent remained. But everything else...
Clothing, sleeping bag, thermarest, 90 rounds of 12-gauge ammunition...
was gone.
Down to the toothbrush.
Also taken away was his ability to make a living. He uses materials found in nature to make jewelry, and all of them were missing when he got back to the campsite. But that came second to more immediate concerns. Without his supplies, a stormy night in the woods would be tough to handle. And so, as afternoon turned into evening, and evening turned into night... he paddled the 15 or 16 miles back to Sitka. What happened in Nakwasina Sound, Tidwell says, was more than petty theft.
It violates any outdoorsman's rule. You know, like the old timers had the cabins and caches and stuff. And if you were in a pinch, it was okay to go in there and take what you needed to survive, but you replaced it. But to steal someone's ability to survive and make a living in one shot, I mean, down to the dirty clothes and toothpaste... It's just not done. It's not really appreciated.
In general, if a person's safety is threatened, there could be charges beyond theft, says Assistant District Attorney Jean Seaton. She said, though, it would depend on the circumstances of the crime. Meanwhile, a group of friends is offering a $600 reward for information that leads to an arrest and conviction in the case. And Tidwell says, even if he doesn't get his stuff back, he just hopes people think twice about how their actions affect others. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production, Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN.